This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more about what we do at sevillepodcast.com. Professor Lauren E. Lemoski of the University of Virginia's Program in Political Philosophy, Policy, and Law addressed the Jefferson Society on October 17, 2008, on the question, "Why should you bother to vote?" He's introduced by Bailey Barfield.
I am pleased and proud to present our speaker for tonight, Professor Lauren Lemoski, the Director of the Political Philosophy, Policy, and Law Department here at the University. Professor Lemoski will deliver a speech entitled, "Why Should You Vote?" Why should you bother to vote? I'm sorry. Professor Lemoski is best known for his work in moral and political philosophy. He's been the recipient of many awards, including the 1991 Machette Prize for his books, Persons, Rights, and the Moral Community. When Hard Heads Collide, A Philosopher Encounters Public Choice, The American Journal of Economics and Sociology, Liberty, Welfare, Goods, Reflection on Clashing Liberalisms, Aid Without Egalitarianism, Assisting Indigent Defendants. Professor Lemoski has held research appointments sponsored by the NEH, the Center for the Study of Public Choice, the Australian National University, and Bowling Green Social Philosophy and Policy Center. Lemoski's teaching interests include the philosophy of religion, medieval philosophy, and other episodes in the history of philosophy, as well as many topics in moral and political philosophy. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I present to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It is truly a pleasure and an honor to be appearing here at this august society. It is not my first appearance here. When I came to the university some 6 years ago, I discovered the Jeff, and I thought it was one of the best things about UVA. After I think going to two or three of these talks here, they allowed me to start sitting on that side of the room. So I feel like I truly am one of you. Normally, though, when I'm here, I'm sitting down. And now I'll try it from up here. Could I ask how many of you plan to vote? Whoa, that's a large number. And no doubt many of you are telling the truth. So I want to talk with you about that act, because after all, it's going to take you time to do it. You know, you might have to get up extra early, say before noon or something, to make sure you can fit everything in, stand in a line, maybe worry about shads that hang or levers that are stuck. So question is, why should you bother to vote? And there's an easy answer to that. This is a country in which patriots have fought and died so that we would possess the right to vote. To disdain that privilege would be untrue to them. Now, that's a good answer, but it doesn't hold up for obvious reasons. I hope you can see that there's a difference between having a right and that right being valuable and exercising the right. All right? You all have the right to marry. If you were deprived of a right to marry, that would be an injustice to you, be a harm to you. Does it follow that you all ought to get out next week or next month and get married? Or ever? I don't think so. You have the right to worship. Does that mean if you don't drag yourself off to church on Sunday or some other day that your contempt of that right? No, the right to worship is a right not to worship. The right to vote is a right not to vote as well. So that's not a good reason. But you probably listen to public service announcements telling you that, gosh, this is the time when you can make a difference. If you want to be heard in Washington, you'll go out and vote. But that's false. You won't make a difference, or rather, you might. You might if the electorate is otherwise tied. And your vote is the swing vote that makes the difference as to which of the candidates wins. Now, there's a chance that that will be the case. It's a lesser chance, though, than that you'll get hit by a bus on the way to the polls. So the going to vote on the basis of the likelihood that you will change outcomes. Anyway, it's possible, but if I were you, you know, I would invest my fortune in lottery tickets, because your chances are much higher. So if that's the case, then why bother to vote? And that's what I want to talk about with you tonight, also to hear your answers to it, because obviously you've thought about it, you're intending to vote, you just told me that, so I'd be interested to hear your reason. If we were in my classroom now instead of here, I would start pointing to people and making you give me answers to do that. I know that's not exactly in keeping with the protocols of the Jeff, but we could always start new traditions, right? All right. To be brief here, you say there are essentially three main lines of argument as to why citizens ought to vote. One is based on considerations of what might be called a utilitarian form, in terms of the great amounts at stake that even when there's a small chance to make a difference, one ought to do so. Second kind of argument for a reason to vote is a generalization argument. By that I mean answer to the question, well, what if nobody went out to vote? How would you like that? And therefore, if you don't, then you're expecting others to do things while you shirk. And a third kind of argument involves what I'll call the expressive nature of voting. And let me explain that when I get to it. First, on the large stakes argument. Normally, we don't have reason to take a kind of extremely small chances in terms of changing our actions. So if there's a 1 in a million chance that if you go off skiing, you will ski off the edge of the mountain and die, most people aren't going to stay in the valley because of that small chance. But suppose the philosopher Derek Parfit asks, suppose you're a nuclear engineer, and by taking a few minutes of upkeep activity, you could address a 1 in a million chance of a nuclear reactor overheating and exploding. Would it be worth doing it? And the answer is, it seems yes. I mean, nuclear meltdowns are real bad things. Even a 1 in a million chance, that sort of carnage, is 1 in a million too many. And similarly, say the difference, we're now facing interesting economic times. Suppose one of the candidates, if elected, would lead to, say, a 0.5% per year increase in the gross domestic product more than the other. I won't fill in any names here. That would be an enormous payoff once you sum it over the 300 million Americans. Would it be worth spending 15 minutes of time? Even the small chance could make a difference in this regard. This is sort of argument that has been given as to why, even though the chance that your vote will be decisive is minuscule, still the stakes are so high that even a minuscule chance is worth investing that time. I don't think this is a very effective argument. I think if we look at the analogy with the nuclear meltdown, we can see why it isn't. I know the members of this society are a remarkably diverse and contentious group, but I suspect even here there isn't anybody who thinks that on balance it would be good to have a nuclear meltdown. If you do think that, you, especially you probationers, speak to the officers immediately. Don't want to know this. I mean, clearly this is a disaster. Is it the case we have that kind of knowledge concerning candidates for election? Well, we might think so. You might think that, you know, it would be terrible for the country if Obama gets elected, if McCain does it. But note that there are going to be others who are equally intense about in the other direction. That is to say, there's nothing like the consensus, the sort of epistemic fixity, if you will, of this kind of political estimation of stakes that there is with the other. And it's, you know, it's no surprise that that's so. Politics is a contentious discipline. Democrats invest millions and millions of dollars and hours to try to persuade us that the Republicans are a fount of disaster. The Republicans invest equally to persuade us of the other. They want to stir our emotions so that we will support the favorite candidate and so on. That is to say, we are subject to suasion that by no means is disinterested. So we ought to question our judgments in this case. Second, we might think we know what the different candidates will do when they get in office, but we can be mistaken about that. There are people who in 1964 took, you know, very intently Lyndon Johnson's warning that if the wrong candidate is elected, America will be enmeshed in a disastrous land war in Asia. Well, we were, and some of us think the wrong candidate was elected, but it wasn't the one Johnson met. Question for the probationers. Who ran on the slogan, "He kept us out of war"? You ought to all know that one. Your fellow society member. What did Wilson do the year after he got elected? World War, brought us into war. So George Bush, remember he read, you know, "No more nation building." Well, all right, I hardly need to push this further to note that our political knowledge in this regard is, you know, entirely fragmentary, hypothetical. We might have firm convictions at the time about what will or won't happen if so-and-so is elected and whether it's good or bad. But history reveals to us, I think, just how tenuous such estimations are. So in this sort of case, we don't have an analogy to a meltdown at all. What we have is a teeny tiny chance of making a difference, a minuscule chance, where it's quite unclear whether the difference we make would be a real good thing, a real bad thing, or none of the above. I could go further on this point, but we can discuss this afterwards if you think I've misstated this. Let me go on to what might seem more plausible to you, a generalization argument. You've heard these, aren't you? Probably used them before. So if you're out with a friend who empties a beer can and then throws it onto the highway, I meant a Diet Coke can, throws it onto the highway, you might say, "Why are you doing that?" And said, look, one more can isn't going to make a difference. And you, quite properly at this point, said, "Yeah, but what if everybody did that? Right? How would you like that?" And if he says, "Well, not everybody does that. Some people aren't the complete slobs that I am," that's not a justification. It's just the reverse. What then if nobody went to vote? How would you like that? Everybody is too lazy to bother to go to the ballot. And if you don't like that, then response is, well, you shouldn't shirk either. Do your part. Okay? Generalization arguments are good ones for reasons that you will examine if and when, I certainly hope when, you take a philosophy course in ethics. All right? Something every UVA student should do. But I promise that'll be my last unpaid ad for the talk. But one thing you will discover, maybe you're already thinking that now, is that not every generalization argument is a persuasive one. So let me give you an example. And if you plan to go to law school here, you're kidding. It's so refreshing to be in a group where not everybody in the room is thinking about law school. Suppose somebody were to say to you, "You want to go to law school? What if everybody did that? We'd have nothing but lawyers all around. Who would grow fruit and vegetables for us? Who would clean the street? Who would take care of the plumbing? You shouldn't be going to law school." Well, I don't think that's a real good argument. A generalization argument in the form, "What if everybody went to law school?" doesn't carry conviction in the way that, "What if everybody just dumped his trash public lands does?" Now, why not? And the reason is, I think, and again, I'm racing through a lot of stuff quickly, but the reason is that in cases like littering, like polluting, driving your 8-mile-per-gallon Hummer, taking a shortcut across the newly planted grass. In these cases, you're making an exception. You're taking advantage of others' forbearance because they don't pollute like that. They don't litter. They don't cut across the grass. You get to enjoy, you know, a relative amount of an uncluttered environment in which the grass is growing, etc. Whereas you're not playing your part. In generalization arguments, though they don't work, it's usually because the conduct that isn't generalizable is not taking advantage. If you become a lawyer, you're not taking advantage of those who do other things. Indeed, if anything, you're advantaging them. After all, if your choice is between law and farming, then by going into law and stuff, you're making things a little bit better for the other farmers, a little less competition. And indeed, we can generalize this across the entire economy, bring in Adam Smith, the division of labor, stuff like that. Were you in my class where we did that? No, somebody here was. I thought, that's right. Division of labor is precisely the case in which individuals doing different things, non-generalizable, makes things better, where if they all did the same, it would make it worse. Now, which is voting like? Is voting like littering? Or is it like going to law school in terms of generalization? I think it's like going to law school. When you don't vote, what you're doing, in effect, is you're making everybody else's vote count a little bit more. That is, the fewer the number of voters, the likelier each vote is to make that difference of being decisive. Still quite small, but you're not harming the other voters, just the opposite. Now, there are other reasons and why I think, what if everyone were to do that? We'd have no life forms left. All right, what I'm going to maintain, and I hope we can talk about this, is the generalization argument doesn't work here. By the way, it's not clear how to answer the question, what would it be like if no one voted? You know, when they have the right, maybe it would mean that things are just so great. We've transcended politics. We don't have to worry about, you know, those guys up the road in D.C. I don't know, but at any rate, this one doesn't work. Let me then briefly, and I will be brief, turn to the third line of answer to the question, why should I bother to vote? And this, I think, is the strongest reason. It's the one least represented in the literature on the duty to vote. It's one that was suggested to me, more than a dozen years, and probably two decades ago, by a student once in class who said to me, look, if you don't bother to vote, then you don't have a right to complain about what happens. I see people nodding heads, so sympathize with that. Well, look, I'm going to confess something to you. I thought, now, my students are remarkably ignorant. The right to complain doesn't hinge on whether you'd gone off and voted before and such. You know, what is she thinking of? In retrospect, though, I think I was the one who was ignorant and didn't really attend to what this student was trying to say. And what I think she was trying to say is something like this, that look, you know, for better or worse, you know, these acts of political engagement and political decision-making have an enormous influence on the way things go for you and everybody around you. Our civil environment depends so much on political activity. And here, if you can't at least contribute some attention to it, some interest in it. Can't contribute 15 minutes to go off and vote. You thereby detach yourself from stuff that matters a lot to all those around you and to you too. And in doing that, you violate an ethics of concern. It would be like, you know, if somebody fairly close to you dies, right? And instead of going to the funeral, you go off to play frisbee. And when somebody says, well, I said, well, you know, you can't bring them back. You know, when they're stiff. So what does a funeral do? I think you miss the point of what a funeral is. It's not just to rush them into the ground. Right? It's to express sort of concern that isn't just this kind of forward-looking consequentialist factor. It's a way to show that this person's life is enmeshed with yours and to express sorrow for that which you can't do anything about. And that's what makes such expression all the more important. So maybe we could say this, that the reason you ought to vote, I ought to vote, we all ought to vote, is to express our engagement in the political destiny of our country. Is that a good reason to vote? Well, I used to think it was. I still think it's the strongest reason. To be honest, I don't think so anymore. And the reason I don't think so isn't because I don't think that expressive engagement with momentous things doesn't matter. It's because voting is just too trivial to carry that much weight to it. I mean, to just show up somewhere, maybe, you know, not even knowing who any of the candidates are other than the top of the ballot, or to just go there because your professor is giving you the election day off or something, to just cast a vote. What does that mean? I don't think it means very much. Note that the expression here is binary. It's on, off. You vote for or against this candidate. You're not able to make any discriminations of policy matters, of disaggregating all parts of the package, say what really matters, in the way you can at a Jeff Society debate, or sitting on a bar stool next to somebody, or just reading a book, taking a philosophy class and debating these things. These are expressively rich. The mere act of voting is expressively attenuated. Nonetheless, people do go and vote. Why? I think going to vote is less like an engineer watching out for a nuclear reactor or a conscientious citizen not littering, because if everyone did, it'd be a terrible thing, than it is like going to a UVA football game. Some of you, I hope, have had time, the inclination to go off to a UVA game. People who go there will sit up in the stadium, they will cheer for the team, and they will not do so because they judge that the marginal effect of one more cheer might make the difference between outscoring UNC or losing to them. That would be a weird reason to go to a football game. And I'm not saying that cheering doesn't have any effect, but that's not why fans go. They go because they're into football. They're into the expressive activity of cheering for their team. if you don't like football, if you don't get into it, then I think there's no reason to go to football games. You know, special considerations aside. Football is great for football fans. Bowling is great if you like bowling. Singing in glee clubs, terrific if you like singing. Some people are into politics. They kind of enjoy studying about the candidates, thinking about their position, and just going off expressing their support by pulling the lever for candidate X. If you're one of those people, if you're really into that activity, then I think you have good reason to do it. But if you're not, you know, if you like football more than voting, then I think you have better reason to go to, well, you can't go to a football game on a Tuesday, but you can hit golf balls or do whatever else. I think that the public spirit message we get, that it's your duty to go out and vote, and if you don't do it, you're being a bit shabby as a citizen. I think that ultimately no good argument can be given for that. We're being sold a bill of goods. Now, if I can take just two more minutes to conclude, I think you ought to be real, real suspicious of philosophers, social thinkers who try to tell you something that is in opposition to the well-considered judgments of, you know, of what Aristotle would have called the many or the wise. Why believe this person? What could account for the fact that so many have gotten this so wrong? So you ought to demand from me some error theory of why this belief there is a duty to vote is so widespread. And let me give you this in a nutshell, and then I will stop. First, at one point in the history of Republican with a small r, Republican government, voting and other political activity was much more front and center. It certainly was in the time of the namesake of this institution. All right? But, you know, times change. What may have been the case for a small elite in revolutionary Virginia might not apply to a vast democracy like the United States. Second, it's in the interest of it's in the interest of politicians to want us to believe that we are doing our duty as citizens if we go out and vote. One thing, they're just saying we vote for them, but in general, if we believe that voting is what citizens ought to do, then we go out and vote, and then for the remaining days of the term, they go off doing their earmarks and having their nice lunches with lobbyists and such, and we don't think we have much by way of political duty in that regard. So one day a year, we get to feel good about our political activity, and that's it. A third reason why is we like to feel good about ourselves. If to feel good about myself, doing my civic part, I thought that I had to devote 2 years of my life to the Peace Corps, or I had to be organizing 20 hours a week. That's a substantial burden. It's not a bad thing to do. It may be a heroic thing to do, but it's very costly to individuals to do that. One of the great things about the myth of the duty to vote is that it enables us to feel a fair bit of self-satisfaction. I've done my duty. I've gone off and voted. And we like feeling good about ourselves. But in this case, we really are doing it on the cheap. So, Tuesday, Election Day, by all means, go off and vote if you care to do so. If you're more into knitting a quilt or singing a barbershop quartet harmonies, that's just as meritorious. Do what suits you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Again, it's great to see you.
Thank you for having me again.
When you started off the talk, you talked about the patriotism of going back kind of to the myth of the founders. And I wonder, as you alluded at the end of how times change, if your theory might be plenty rational, but for certain communities not particularly reasonable. And I wonder if you've missed the symbolic reasons why. You talked about expressive, but I wonder if there's another level where one might want to talk about the symbolic reasons. So if you're part of a community who has only recently been allowed to vote, right, the way you would measure the value for the ability to vote would be very different from the ground that you've given us from. For those who have had to go through the fire hoses and the dogs, or you can even think of very recently, women in the Muslim world. Right, and in those striking pictures we have of the blue ink on the finger saying, I did this. How, in a sense, have you accounted for the motivations for those people? Because it doesn't seem like you can account for them with the paradigms that you've laid out. What I'd offer is, what about the symbolic reasons? As an African American, if I watch black entertainment television, one of the reasons why they say it's a duty, it's not for, and we don't get into the conditions and the cons and all that good stuff. And that might be good or whatever, but that's not generally where they're coming from. There really is kind of, you owe it to your ancestors, right? There really is a historical reason, and the vote really has a symbolic cultural meaning. An evaluation of that meaning that doesn't fall within the rationalist, the admittedly very rationalist paradigm that you've given. Though one could still say that the motivation could still be quite reasonable.
I think that's an excellent question. I think sometimes there is a duty to vote. If you're on a jury of 12, you damn well do have a duty to vote. In this case, because of the way that, if you're at a department meeting and you tune out, you don't contribute. Then you're failing. If you are a political operative, if you join your forces with others in a common enterprise, then you don't vote. That shows kind of insincerity. If you've been part of a campaign for a right to vote, which finally succeeds, and then you don't bother, then again, I think that could be a violation of the symbolic importance of a vote. So I don't deny that. As I mentioned, I at one point thought that this sort of symbolic, expressive argument for why people ought to vote is a very strong one, or at least the strongest. I guess I don't see it as that strong. Because, it would be interesting here. So what I could do is go around and say, white man, no duty to vote, black man, sort of a duty, women, yes, more so, new citizens, somebody who just got naturalized maybe most of all. But in fact, I think this right to vote is also a right not to vote. To be a citizen among other citizens who, if you're fired up and if voting is a way you could show your concern, then you ought to do it. But if not, then you too have every entitlement to abstain.
I just want to follow up because that's precisely not what I'm asking. And it, like, for some white man to determine who should be, who has value in the vote. What I'm saying is,
no, I was taking your determination.
How have you accounted for the differences in motivations from particularly those that would not be incumbent? So to say that history matters, would be to say, if you got the right to vote 200 years ago, maybe it's a luxury to have a passive attitude toward voting. And maybe that luxurious attitude isn't something that's shared with people who got the right to vote 30 years ago or yesterday.
No.
And in a sense, how have you accounted for history in the way that you're trying to build a general or universal principle about the duty to vote?
Yeah. Perhaps I didn't understand the question. I am not trying to say, certainly, that you ought not vote, that it's irrational to vote. For some people, if you find this personally meaningful, somewhere, if you relate to struggles of your parents and grandparents, if you relate to the campaign for women's suffrage in ways that you can give adequate expression to through voting, then that makes a great deal of sense. If you don't, that could be inadequate conduct. But I would say the same about somebody who is deeply committed to traditions of UVA football or the Jeff, right? That if you talk that talk, and if you claim that it, but then you don't act on that, then there's a kind of implicit hypocrisy in this. What I'm denying is that there's a general duty to vote. And I should have made that clearer, because it could be the case that for some people in this room, if you don't vote, you're letting people down. You've been part of a campaign, you put up yard signs, you've given money, whatnot, and you're committed in a way that does indeed give you a strong reason to vote. But it isn't one that's your reason. It isn't a general citizen's reason. That would be how I'd respond. But I take your question very seriously. I think it's important. The gentleman in the back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Molowski.
Thank you.
My question was to tie that note to the purely rationalistic point of view.
The purely what?
The purely rationalistic point of view. Wouldn't it be better, and I'm playing obviously the devil's advocate here, I don't personally hold this view, wouldn't the argument, can't the argument be made that it's actually a lot more useful to, for example, on election day, to work on, for example, driving people who don't have transportation to the polls, back and forth. So as opposed to you going and making a difference with just one vote, helping out people, tens of people, making a difference through your homeless. Perhaps, of course, I might be contradicting myself, if maybe there is an idealistic making to this, but isn't it a lot more rational to do that as opposed to just the single active one person voting? Thank you.
Yes. That is, if the aim is to maximize the chance of favorite candidate winning, right, then there are other ways of doing it besides voting, like driving people to the polls, like offering people $5 to go vote for your guy. Now, you might have a hard time verifying this, but, there are market imperfections everywhere, as we've learned these past couple of months.
Not necessarily for your favorite candidate, but just your neighbors, for example.
Oh, just because you want more people to vote?
Who would be going in the case of the United States to remain
vote for the party? If the point is to get large numbers of people voting, yes. That may indeed be the optimal way to do it. Now, why you'd want that, I'm not sure of. But, all right, well, no, no, I'll take your point. Let's go to this side of the room.
Thank you for coming to the Saturday. And my question is maybe attended on your first point about the states, but I believe that everybody is in their interest to place a vote. For instance, a single mother has a choice between a candidate that's wanting to take away welfare and a candidate that's going to uphold or reform and improve welfare.
Yep.
Isn't it in her interest to give that little effort, put the check mark next to the name, to support the candidate that will help her out more?
Is it?
Well, I believe so.
Why? What makes it to be in her interest?
If the candidate that, if she can, if that little ounce of effort that she puts can perhaps put one more tally to the grand scheme of things, she's doing what little effort she can to help herself.
Yep.
Now it's not, now the reward may or may not happen, but it's such a small effort, and the rewards are great, maybe really great, but could be really hurtful if she doesn't. I just seem that it's rational to do that.
It could be. So if, for example...
Everyone can have their own interests. One person can want welfare to be taken away. One person can want the welfare to be kept.
Nope. It is in her interest to vote if she's the only one who's voted. In electorate of one, she's decisive. In which case, you know, that the probability that her vote will make a difference is one. Suppose there's an electorate of three, and you don't know how the others are going to vote. Half the time, her vote would make the difference when they're split 1-1. In a very large electorate, though, the chance that her vote will make any difference is going to be very, very, very small. Should she vote anyhow? Well, rational choice theory will explain to you that the expected utility of the vote is the difference between the preferred alternative and the less preferred alternative multiplied by the probability that your action will make the difference here. Even if it's a very large difference, if the probability is tiny, suppose it's $20,000 a year. That's a lot. I doubt our welfare system now would offer anything like that. $20,000 a year. Suppose the chance being decisive, let's make it a large one, 1 in a million. That would mean that her expected return to a vote is 1/5 of 1 cent, if I did the math wrong. Well, it's going to cost her more than this, certainly gas to get there. I suspect she has other activities in that 10 or 15 minutes that are worth more than 1/5 of a cent to her. So if you persuade her to vote because it's in her interest, you owe her an apology. Because you know the math now, and you know that you've just screwed her out of better opportunities. Right? But it might mean you'll have a good future in politics. I'll go to this side and then back here.
No. Yes, sir. Now, Professor, thank you for coming and speaking to us tonight. Your entire argument, to my understanding, relies a lot on numbers. And you talked about the probability of the vote being hacked in the single vote. I question, though, how do you reconcile it with history? I can point to two instances. One, obviously, the Compromise of 1876, the idea of Tilden versus Hayes. Very, very few votes could have swung that election either way. More recently, in 2000, the so-called Nader vote. If voters had, you know, chosen Gore over Nader, most likely we'd have a President Gore now. I guess my question is, how does that reconcile with your theory that even in a huge election like that, every vote does count?
Or if in 2000 this gentleman, instead of driving voters to the polls, had bought reading glasses for the sweet old people in Dade County so they could see which where on the punch card they're knocking it out. Maybe that would have swung it. I'm not saying that election results are inevitable, that there's no way one can make a difference. So, for example, if you could have, in June of that year, kidnapped Nader, and just so he disappeared, maybe permanently, maybe not, that could have made an enormous difference. You're right. But look, it's interesting. When we look even at our very closest elections, and as I recall, I was too young to vote in the 1876 election, but wasn't it the case that Hayes actually had a minority of the popular vote? In that case, as well as in 2000, where it's terribly close in Florida, unprecedented, still, you would have had to get you and a few hundred of your best friends all to vote and all to vote the same way to swing the election. So to me, what that shows is, yes, one vote can be decisive. It can be, but the probability is infinitesimal.
If I can follow up on that, real quick, you offer some alternative examples. However, those still have the same end in mind. That means civic interaction, still looking forward an election. How does that compare with the idea of if you have kidnapped Nader and possibly voted or gone and played basketball? Obviously, one, well, they both have different ends, but one is the same end as voting. So again, I guess my question is, how can you reconcile the idea of not voting with saying it has the same effect or lack thereof of voting?
I'm not sure I follow the question. Explain the reference to playing basketball.
For instance, you say instead of voting, you could drive people to the polls or give the elderly.
That was this gentleman who said drive people to the polls.
Anything for that matter still has the end of political interaction.
Yep.
You say, though, however, if you can either vote or drive these people or kidnap Mater or, you know, many other things, or go play basketball, go to a football game. The one group has the end of civic interaction. The other group has personal choice, I guess, is the end of personal happiness. I guess my big question then is how does that same end have the same benefit if you're looking to... I mean, if you say that by having more people or even a small minority can make a difference, wouldn't you say that going playing basketball makes less of a difference in the broader scheme?
If you play basketball, your chance of swinging the election is zero.
Right.
If you go and vote, your chance of swinging the election is positive, but so close to zero that there's barely any difference. I would then ask you for a reason why something so close to zero should be taken account of, when normally things like that we don't take account of. I think it's because many of us want to find a way to support this myth of the active, involved citizen who goes and votes. Maybe there is a good reason to support that. I'm just unable to see it myself. You've been very patient.
We have time for one more short question.
Who's got a short question? Tell you what, if you guys want to just give me questions, and I won't answer them, but I'll pick one to answer, the one that I think I won't make a fool of myself. You go, then you.
Okay. Real quick, are you more concerned that people would vote to be in the kind of form vote, or that they just become opposite another thing and they don't have the same opinion as the first one? So, which one are you arguing
for? Okay, second.
Thanks for coming, by the way, and for your talk. I wonder, you talk about the right to vote and the right not to vote, and those being the same thing. I wonder what you think about policies like felony disenfranchisement. And things like that, where we actually take away the right to vote. I'd assume you'd still
Thank you.
Thank you for your speech. What do you think of institutions like Liberty University canceling classes and facilitating voting? And do you think schools and businesses should make efforts to make voting easier on individuals?
Okay. In reverse order, if I weren't a smartass, I probably wouldn't say this, but I think the more classes Liberty University cancels, the better for its students. Now I'm going to pretend I didn't say that. Disenfranchisement of, look, I mean, I think that I was asked by somebody, maybe somebody here, if I would let her come into my classroom, take 5 minutes to tell my students what to get on and vote and such. And so, look, I think it's okay for people to vote. I think the idea of Liberty trying to swing Virginia for Franklin Pierce or whoever was the last president they really liked, I have my doubts about. I think perpetual disenfranchisement for those convicted of a felony is an extraordinarily dubious policy. I think whether people choose to vote or not is a minor matter, but how we treat those convicted of crimes this country is a disgrace in terms of the enormous numbers that we incarcerate, the racial disparities and of course class disparities involved, and so, and the idea that, yeah, you've paid your debt, this is it, but stay the hell away from the polls. But note that this is not, this is a matter for right to vote, okay? And that's different, and it's also one that can be momentous with regard to, in terms of informed citizenry, and people going to the polls who don't really know a lot of stuff. John Stuart Mill, who's one of the greatest men who ever lived, and somebody I love teaching, he gave an argument, one of his books, that those who were university educated should get more than one vote because they knew more stuff. And so this was not his finest hour. Basically, I would say that you don't have to worry about whether a particular voter is uninformed. The American electorate, by and large, is so massively ignorant in almost every regard that, you know, they kind of balance each other out in this regard. But we couldn't know more about this for reasons that we couldn't know that Wilson would take us to war the next year. We couldn't know that George Bush would be expanding the welfare state more than anybody since Johnson or maybe Lenin. So you don't have to worry about that, but for some reason the U.S. pulls through anyhow. Up until now. Thank you very much. Thank you. It was a real privilege to be able to come. Thank you.